Recently, famed journalist Ben Swan asked me, "What is anarcho-capitalism?" I thought you might like to hear our discussion.
This is going to be an interesting show because in our first hour, we're going to be talking with Lou Rockwell of LouRockwell.com. He is one of the, one of the foremost authorities right now in the country in terms of especially something called anarcho-capitalism. We're going to talk to him a little bit about that, what exactly anarcho-capitalism consists of. But also, you know, one of these guys who has been pushing the idea of libertarianism and really the liberty movement before there was a liberty movement in the United States. And so I'm interested in hearing from him specifically on media and how he sees things beginning to shift. On the phone with me right now as we get the show kicked off is Lou Rockwell. Lou, thanks so much for being on.
Ben, great to be with you.
If this is the first time we've talked, it's absolutely an honor to talk with you. Your reputation precedes you, certainly. The founder of the Von Mises Institute in Alabama. And you have pushed forward a lot of these ideas of sovereign money, of, limited government. I guess the way to describe it is you're referred to as anti-war, anti-state, and pro-market. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the little slogan at the top of my website.
So let's talk about some of those things. What does it mean, first of all, to be pro-market in the United States today? Because my opinion is that we really do not have a free market remaining anymore, that every part of the market has some form of regulation or government involvement on some level. Is that true?
Sure, it's true. And governments at all levels. I mean, it's not only the federal government, but state governments, local governments, county governments, go down the list of all the horrors. If the free market weren't working at all in our country, we'd all be dead. I mean, we'd be like, even in the Soviet Union, at its worst, there were aspects of the free market, mostly underground, of course.
Right, what people refer to as the black market.
Yeah, the underground economy, the black market. So we have that in this country too, thank goodness. It's huge and growing. But there are still great entrepreneurs and great investors and great employers and employees and just many great aspects of the capitalist system still going on. We still see industries growing and we see good things happening. That's because of the market, not because of the state. The government is, of course, entirely anti-market, although maybe I used to think that maybe they had learned they didn't want a Soviet system because then all the people in the government didn't have any resources either. I remember
right.
Yuri Maltsev, who was a former Soviet economist, telling me about towards the end of the regime, there was a car accident. The local party leader was part of the accident. His trunk popped open, and he was seen by the people in the town street to have sausages in his trunk, at which point he's pulled out of the car and beaten up because people thought, what an outrage, because they didn't have any sausages. So, you know, when you get down to where maybe the ruling class has got cars that don't work and a few sausages in the trunk, you know, even maybe they, one, I would say an unfortunate aspect of a capitalist order, because it's not, I mean, it's the parasite of the government doing this, but a capitalist order does give the government far more resources to do damage with, to loot, to steal, to make war, to take away our liberties, to give, you know, tanks and MRAPs to little towns, police forces, and all the various other things they're doing. And maybe this has always been true in human history, a race, as Murray Rothbard put it, between power and market, between freedom and between the enemies of freedom. So, yes, I would say certainly by the standards of the founding fathers, even by the standards of the 19th century, we don't live in a free country anymore. I mean, we have our civil liberties are tremendously circumscribed. There are constant wars going on. The media, there's always been something wrong with the media, but today the media, the mass media, is just entirely spokesman for the government. I mean, we might as well be in the Soviet Union for just constant propaganda on behalf of whatever the government wants to do, mainly loot us, hurt us, start wars, kill people in other countries, and the U.S. government has as its international ambition to be the world government. And probably it's the only government in history that actually had the resources to potentially be the world government. So that's why they're, you know, doing so much, making Russia an enemy, one of the few countries that's not controlled by the U.S. So that's why they're hated. China, Iran, Syria, anybody who's not controlled by the U.S. has to be destroyed. in order to bring about global hegemony. So there's all kinds of horrendous stuff going on. On the other hand, there's great creative market-based things happening in this country, in Europe, and in the former Soviet Union and former Red China and so forth. We're seeing many great, happy, wonderful things happening. So I try to be like Murray Rothbard was. While I'm a short-term pessimist as to troubles, a long-term optimist that maybe freedom can actually win. And when I see, I have the pleasure of dealing with so many young people, and they are so much more sophisticated, know so much more than I did when I was their age, and I was interested in all this stuff, but they're much better read, and they don't buy the government lies. For them, the typical professor at a state university or a politician might as well have a little sign on his forehead flashing, liar, liar. Certainly they know what not to believe. They need help in knowing what to believe, and that's where organizations like the Mises Institute come in. There's this constant battle, and there are reasons to be optimistic, there are reasons to be pessimistic. I must say that one thing that really worries me, I mean, are they actually risking an atomic war with the Russians? I mean, we saw recently the NATO general, who's an American general in charge of NATO forces, said that U.S. forces could potentially be involved in all of this. So if we actually have a direct military confrontation between the Russians and the Americans, that's a very scary business. I guess it would start off as a conventional war, but would it end as a conventional war? I don't know. And certainly we know the U.S. has been happy to drop atomic weapons on defenseless cities in the past. Would they do that again? I hope not.
That becomes the question, doesn't it? It becomes the question.
The famous neoconservative called Herman Kahn, who was the founder of the Hudson Institute and very influential so-called defense intellectual. He wrote a book called Thinking the Unthinkable, where he advocated that the U.S. and its imperial ambitions should use atomic weapons on a regular basis. So there's some people who actually believe in this. And as we know, under World War One and other wars, sometimes things can get out of hand where nobody's intending in the beginning. So it's a terrible thing. Obama said he doesn't want a war with Russia. I hope that's the case. We've seen some of these generals go up against him on terms of military power, what the military should be doing.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. Well, Lou, stay right there. We're coming up on a break here. So on the other side of the break, though, let's talk a little bit more in specific about what NATO is doing right now, Russia, Crimea, and also how media is a part of that problem, I think, overall in the way that they deal with the American public. Much more with Lou Rockwell when we come back. And welcome back to the Ben Swan Radio Show here on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. Glad that you're with us. We're talking today with none other than Lou Rockwell, who really needs no introduction. If you are even a passing libertarian, then you know this man's name and the contribution that he's made to the libertarian movement and the liberty movement overall over the past many years. And Lou, we were talking before the break specifically about Russia, Crimea, NATO. We just put together a piece on this, but as you have probably seen, Anders Rasmussen, who's really the chief of NATO, calling for nations that are involved in NATO, the 28 member countries, to increase military spending. Of course, that's his answer to take on the quote-unquote Russian threat. But when you break down the numbers, it's something like $990 billion was spent in 2012 by NATO countries on military alone, versus about $90 billion by Russia on military alone. And we're talking about a gap there of $900 billion, which is just incredible. How much do you think this plays into the fact that the public is just uneducated on these issues?
Well, they're uneducated, and they're also easily pushed into fear and loathing. So if a lot of people, if they're told, hey, now we got to hate the Russians, they'll hate the Russians. I mean, certainly it worked in previous eras when the Russians probably had the worst government in the history of the world, the Lenin-Stalin government. Horrendous stuff that went on. Of course, Stalin was the U.S. ally in World War II.
That's right.
Joe, as they called him. So obviously the U.S. government didn't think too badly of Stalin. But that's not Russia today. I mean, they have a lower tax rate than we do. Please oppress me like that. And you'll notice whenever a country is being demonized, we're never shown pictures of it on television.
That's right.
But they're just, if you look at downtown Moscow today and its business district, looks like Houston. I mean, huge skyscrapers and bustling cars and people and well-dressed people and so forth. So this is still a far poorer country than the U.S. or Western Europe. After all, they were under communism for many decades, and that had a horrible effect on just every aspect of life, and their life expectancy, for example, is far lower. Their disease rates are far higher still today because of the horrific effects of socialism under all the communist leaders. But, you know, they're not threatening us, and they couldn't. I mean, they're not in the same league. It's a much poorer country, and as you point out, just an infinitesimal military budget. This is true of China, too, by the way, as compared to the U.S., and we constantly hear the creeps in Washington saying, oh, we got to spend more on quote-unquote defense. Well, you know, right. As far as I can tell, the U.S. spends nothing on defense, spends everything on offense, and it's, again, to run the world. So it's alarming when you see something like NATO, which is a bunch of unelected creeps who are threatening, in effect, threatening a war that would involve the U.S. and involve other countries. So I'm hoping that people in Europe are not going to want this to happen. For one thing, there's been a happy economic relationship with Russia and Europe in terms of natural gas and oil and other things. You know, aren't there enough wars going on? I mean, there are wars going on all over the world. U.S. is attacking drones and otherwise. People sure. All over the world, every day, all the time. Maybe Barack signs the death orders over his scrambled eggs in the morning. I don't know what the actual method of this is. But it's terrible stuff. If you started to use atomic weapons, and of course they have battlefield, you know, they have bazookas that have atomic warheads and artillery shells and so forth. It doesn't have to be a giant bomber dropping a giant bomb. So I don't know. It's scary. NATO seems like they want a war. And NATO, just like the EU, would like to be a government, would like to have its own military and not just the national militaries that are part of NATO.
Well, don't you think, too, that NATO itself has become almost irrelevant? I mean, it was kind of constructed during the Cold War as a response to the Soviets, that this was going to be an alliance that could stand against them. I would say over the last certainly 20 years, NATO has almost become irrelevant in the international conversation, and it seems as if this becomes the opportunity that these opportunists will use to say, well, look, see, no, we are relevant. There is value to us being in existence. And not only that, but we need to be strengthened and we need to, as you said, perhaps become our own military. And I see that even the neocons in the United States just salivating over the idea of resurrecting a Cold War because, look, another war in the Middle East. They know the American public's tired of it. I think the American public demonstrated that by resisting and pushing back against overt strikes on Syria and on Damascus. And so they're saying, look, we've got to find a way to kind of reinvigorate the desire for Americans to be involved in war. They call, you know, guys like Bill Kristol will call Americans war weary. I don't think they're war weary. I think they're better informed than they have been. And they're sick of this just constant cycle of war that we've been living under for the past 12 years, 13 years.
Well, it may be much longer than that, but it's certainly there have been, you know, just look since World War II, I mean, there have been many, many wars that have taken place that the U.S. has been involved in. You know, the U.S. is a gigantic warfare state. It's by far the biggest warfare state in the history of the world. It's got by far the biggest military. It's got, you know, this huge military budget. It's got every kind of horrible killer weapon that you could possibly conceive of. And yeah, I think your analysis of NATO is exactly right. This is, by the way, all governments and quasi-governments are constantly trying to get popular support for their own expansion. So, yeah, NATO, which was formed in order for the U.S. to occupy Europe, that's what I would argue was actually going on. The U.S. still occupies Western Europe all these years after World War II. And because the Soviet Union, because of the nature of socialism, was always a very poor country, very poor, far poorer than, say, today's Russia. They just didn't have the wherewithal. They couldn't even trust their own troops. NATO was part of U.S. aggression, not actually a defensive alliance, because there was no way the Russians could have done it. They just didn't. Even World War II, they were only able to fight with vast foreign aid from the U.S. NATO was, always been a bad organization, always an arm of U.S. hegemony, just like all the other post-World War II institutions, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. I mean, these are all designed to increase the reach and the power of the U.S. So now they're, yes, you're exactly right, they are salivating for a war. Maybe we should have General Bill Kristol, put him in uniform, give him a gun, and you know, let him lead the troops.
Right, rather than warmongering from behind some desk.
Yeah, rather than his typewriter. Typewriter in his fancy office.
Well, and I think we see that. We see that kind of developing on several different fronts. But I also think there is a desire to see Russia as the enemy, the United States as the good guy, that is almost intrinsically built into American DNA. And it happens through our public school system. It happens through media. It happens through politicians. And I think for most Americans, these archetypes are so strong. Look, it's like Rocky IV, right? We know who the good guy is and we know who the bad guy is. And Ivan Drago's still the bad guy and Rocky's still the good guy. And it's so deeply embedded into us as Americans. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort on the side of media to be able to say, we're going to push these archetypes in your mind and remind you that we have a very real enemy that is Russia or the Russians.
Neocons have always especially hated the guts of Russia, so they're all looking forward to what they would hope is another war.
They've got their fingers crossed. Lou Rockwell, stay with us. On the other side of the break, I want to talk to you about this thing called anarcho-capitalism. What exactly is that? How does it work? And is there any example of it you can point to in our current system? Much more with Lou when we come back. And welcome back to the Ben Swan Radio Show here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I've been telling you all week long about this book that has just been released by the Atlas Society. It is called The Republican Party's Civil War, Will Freedom Win? And the idea behind this book is very simple. There's a three-way battle going on in the Republican Party right now, basically between the neocons, which we've been talking about here, the kind of cronies in the party, the libertarian wing, which you might call liberty Republicans, and then the social conservatives. And there's a lot of crossover into those social conservatives and libertarians. It's not so clearly defined as two particular groups, but there's definitely some divisions there. And so the explanation behind this book, the idea behind it by Ed Hudgens, is simply that there are ways to create coalition and ways to stand up for individual freedom, that freedom is what will ultimately win. If you go to BenSwan.com today, you can download a free copy of that book from Amazon. It's up on the top of our homepage. Just click on that link and you can get that book for free. I encourage you to go and download this book. It is a terrific look at the future of the Republican Party and how freedom will ultimately win there. On the phone with me this afternoon is Lou Rockwell. He is the purveyor of LouRockwell.com. He is also the founder of the Von Mises Institute. He is a self-professed anarcho-capitalist. Lou, can you explain to me what that means?
That phrase is Murray Rothbard's, and it was a lot of the anarchism of the 19th century, which was socialist anarchism. People actually thought of they could get rid of the government but live under socialism. So what is anarcho-capitalism? It's the view that... It's also called the non-aggression principle, with the basis of libertarianism, that it's never legitimate to initiate violence or the threat of violence against the innocent. Of course, you can use violence in defense of yourself, but you may never initiate, and you can't allow a government to do it, which, of course, is the great purveyor and initiator of violence in the whole world, is the U.S. government and other governments. An anarchist would say that it is possible to have the free market provide the legitimate services that government provides. There aren't many, of course, but there are some. They would be far more effective done in the market. Far better to have private police who treat you like a customer than government police who, you know, want to taser you and put you in a cage. That is just, from a practical standpoint, from a moral standpoint, that we don't want this horrendous monopoly called the government. We don't need it. We still need defense, we need police, you know, that sort of thing. But these, again, can be provided far more efficiently and far more effectively, far more justly, voluntarily in the market. We have the government, which is a monopoly. For example, it gets to decide how much of your money it's going to take every year. Whatever they'd like to take from you. And of course, anarcho-capitalists and libertarians would argue that the government activities have a different name. Taxation is actually theft. If it's done in the private sector, it's theft. When it's done by the government, oh, it's, you know, taxation for public services. And conscription, the draft, actually kidnapping and so forth. So we can go down the list. So everything the government does is illegitimate, even though they spend their time with huge propaganda in the government schools and through the government-friendly media and all their allies who are getting some of the government dough, constantly telling us how you know, we have to have government for civilization. If we didn't have government, why, we'd all be killing each other. Well, too many, of course, there's too much killing going on, done by the government or by the government that can't provide any help against crime. I'd like to see Obama, for example, get rid of the crime in the District of Columbia. It seems to me that's an actual, might be an achievable, it's a small area, an achievable goal, rather than worrying about what's going on in the Ukraine. But needless to say, of course, they don't care. They don't care about crime because crime is against regular people. They only care about things that are done against the government. Then, of course, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world and it has to be stopped.
That's an interesting idea. I mean, when we talk about acts of aggression, for instance, you know, you're describing certainly when we talk about government being responsible for death, to, you know, talk about military and conflicts overseas, as they call them, conflicts. You know, we have drone strike programs and so many people being killed. And as you said, the idea is, well, without government, people will die and ultimately it'll be chaotic. But I think you could also argue for the person living in Yemen right now, life is chaotic, not because of the, you know, lack of government, but because of a overseas government that's very organized in its process of attacking and killing people.
No, and of course, besides taxation, the other way they pay for what they do is what's in the private sector called counterfeiting, in the government's called monetary policy. And they just, in effect, print up the money, even though it has a horrendous effect on the economy and on private property and on the producers and on the decent people, aids the banksters, it of course aids the government. Look at their court system. They're always the judge in their own case.
Mm-hmm.
The judge is a government judge. The prosecutor is a government prosecutor. A lot of times people can't afford a lawyer. They get another, a government lawyer allegedly defending them and so forth. I mean, it's sort of the definition of injustice where one party to the dispute is the judge in the case. So there's something wrong with everything the government does. Most of it is illegitimate and immoral and otherwise a social disaster. Are they threatening us with, you know, a potential atomic war? I mean, how many people has the U.S. government killed in its career of wars over the centuries? How many millions? Millions of people. Now, if you talk to any advocate of the government, they, well, they, all those people deserve to be killed, because, of course, anybody killed by the government deserves to be killed. That's their basic rule. So that's whether it's the policeman breaking into your house with the wrong address and shooting you and killing you. Well, you shouldn't have been in there. There's always an excuse for anything the government is doing. But anarcho-capitalists say, from an economic standpoint, from a moral standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint, that the idea that we need a ruling class over us, that we need people who, you know, and of course, government employees are basically paid double what taxpayers are paid. Do we actually need this ruling class over us? Most of us live in a state of anarchy. I mean, we're not shooting up the next door neighbor's house because we'd like his dining room set. We're not knocking people over the head on the street. We act in a peaceful, voluntary way. I would argue that that can be all of society. And if there are criminals, of course, the criminals have to be dealt with. But today we live under the rule of the criminals. So we live under the worst possible system, and we can see what's been happening to the U.S. government, especially since that happy government holiday they must celebrate in secret called 9/11. It pushed back the cause of freedom, and it vastly expanded the power of the government, so that now they spy on everything we do. They control our businesses. They control our neighborhoods. They control our families. Is there anything the government would think about doing that it was in its interest to do and in the interest of its special interests? They would say, oh, we can't do that because it's wrong. You know, that never, whether it start a war, false flags. I mean, how many U.S. wars have been started by false flags? I was thinking about the Vietnam War today. That was, of course, a false flag in the Gulf of Tonkin, where they claim that this little tiny Vietnamese equivalent of a PT boat had attacked a U.S. destroyer. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me you could have known just from that alone that something funny, but it was all made up. It never happened. Later, some of the officers involved told the truth about it, that it was all just made up. And I think that's been the case of many U.S. wars. They're bloodthirsty. Also, as F.A. Hayek pointed out in The Road to Serfdom, in the government, unlike in private society, the worst rise to the top. Whether it's in a company or just in private organizations or whatever, it's not a 100% rule, but in general, the hardest working, smartest people rise to the top. In the government, it's the most demagogic, the most immoral, the most lying, the most pro-killing people, and they enjoy sticking it to the rest of us. I mean, I notice Obama's totally destroyed traffic in Houston over the last couple of days, so that everybody's traffic is bad enough in Houston. But because of his being there, and of course, all the roads are shut down, the main arteries and so forth, they don't actually have to do that for alleged reasons of security. But you know what? They like doing that. They like exercising their power. They like making people uncomfortable and angry. They love it. They love sending kids to war to kill and be killed. These are not nice people. We don't want them ruling us.
We'll have much more with Lou Rockwell on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about media and where we go from here. And welcome back to the Ben Swan Radio Show on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. We've been talking this hour with Lou Rockwell of LouRockwell.com, also the founder of the Von Mises Institute. And you gave us kind of a grim picture before we went to the last break. I think it's reality, right? It's the reality of what government looks like and false flags look like and the reality that we've dealt with these things for many, many decades. You know, really, if not from the founding of this country and even before that, as the human race, humans have dealt with that. Moving forward, though, I'm pretty optimistic. You mentioned this earlier. You said you were a short-term pessimist, a long-term optimist. And I would agree with you. I think I'm in the same boat. I look forward to what is happening in America right now. And I think especially with the advent of the internet and new media and social media, people have this ability to become so much more informed and to have a better understanding of these things. It's really unlike anything in human history, is it not?
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, really, the internet is maybe the greatest communications invention ever, even more than movable type and printing. Such a tremendous thing. And it has enabled people to know far more. They're not dependent anymore on, remember these antique things, the Washington Post, the New York Times? Just lies on paper. The whole newspaper industry is going out of business, which I think is a great thing. On the other hand, we have alternative media. You know, you're an example of somebody who was successful both in the mainstream media and in alternative media. And I think the fact that you moved to the alternative shows what you think about the future. Not only can you do the most good in the alternative media world, but it's going to be successful. It is successful.
Absolutely.
No young person looks at a newspaper.
No.
No young person watches television news at night, the network news and that sort of thing. They're not influenced by it. So there's still obviously huge propaganda, and there are obviously many people who are the non-young who are influenced by official propaganda sources that, again, might as well be Radio Moscow and Izvestia and Pravda from the old Soviet days. There's very little truth in the American mainstream media. It's almost entirely propaganda. I mean, I don't say everything is propaganda. I guess when they say that it's going to be sunny today, maybe that's not propaganda, although the government weather service has got its problems, too. It's just propaganda. I noticed that on MSNBC, there's a show every morning about politics, and they start off with talking about what's the president eating today. I mean, it's like, who is this, right? Louis XIV? I mean, who cares what he's eating today? Worship, government worship.
Yes.
And
yes.
They're, you know, for those of us who don't worship at the altar of the state, there's not much to learn from these people. On the other hand, from the right websites, from the right internet radio, internet television, Ron Paul's channel, for example, there's tremendous, tremendous amounts of real news and real opinion and real facts to be learned. And it's quite a wonderful thing, and this is what young people are going to. You know, if they're watching television, they're watching it on their smartphone. They don't watch it on a set anymore. I mean, these are like things out of the ancient past. So it's fun. It's fun to see what's developing. And I'm optimistic because of young people and because of great technology that's happening and because they can't actually stamp out freedom as much as they'd love to. They can't actually stamp out the market. So I think freedom in the market will win in the long term. But they can do a lot of damage to us in the short term. They already have. We're all far poorer, for example, than we would be if it weren't for the government. We're far poorer. We'd be making Switzerland look poverty-stricken here in America if it hadn't been for the vast redistribution of the government, whether we look at Social Security, all the redistribution to the military, and they take away money from those who earned it and give it to those who didn't earn it. And just human nature, those who didn't earn the money, they don't have the same attitude towards it that those who did earn it. So there's, you know, obviously huge waste, even if they're not murdering people or all their other activities, just huge waste But I think that kids are learning about this sort of thing. They're understanding what the government does to the economy, what the government is doing to their civil liberties, why we don't have to salaam the White House and the central government or the state governments or the local governments or the town governments. These people all live off us by force, by coercion. They, in effect, put a gun to your head with every look at a parking ticket, which threatens you with jail. I mean, everything is a threat, these people. So they act, I was going to say they act like the mafia, but at least the mafia provided actual services that people wanted to buy. So I don't want to smear the mafia. But, I mean, really, the government is a terrible bunch of people.
Well, and it's fascinating, I think, when you step back from where we have been in terms of just kind of the way the public has been duped by a lot of this. The things that you're talking about today on this show, I'd be willing to wager, are things you've talked about for decades. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so you've talked about this for a long time. How surprised are you at how the acceleration of those ideas through America, you know, has taken place because of new media, because of the internet, because of your ability now, people like you, people like Ron Paul, who have the ability to speak to the masses in a way and to share ideas that are really common sense ideas. I mean, when you talk about things like, you know, the police state, when you talk about the manipulation of currency and the theft that is involved in taxation, those are ideas that, you know, even just a short time ago, people wouldn't even discuss. Those would seem like crazy ideas, and now they're becoming, I think, the mainstream idea.
Well, and they certainly are becoming discussable, and people are more and more willing to be persuaded. Even though this, you know, vast propaganda apparatus, again, in the government schools, friendly media, it's all, you know, one line about the glories of the government. People are interested in real economics, Austrian economics. They're interested in real history about the actual history of this country, and not the propagandistic history where the U.S. government has never done anything wrong and, you know, it's the hero of the world and we should all worship it. And let's have more wars. Let's have more killing. Let's have more taxation. And let's have more palaces in Washington, D.C. I don't know if people listening have visited Washington recently, but they're all living very well there. This is, they have all mansions and limos and beautiful homes and restaurants. And these are the scum of the earth who are living like this, and it's not right. So
well,
we should be able to keep our own money.
A lot of people don't realize that during the so-called Great Recession, Washington, D.C. was one of the few places in the country that actually did not see any drop in housing prices. It didn't see layoffs. It didn't see people going through the foreclosure process. It was the exact opposite. It continued to thrive because that's where the center of everything is right now.
That was true during the Great Depression, by the way, too. Funny, they always do very well, the government and the government employees. They're all happy, fat and happy, and living off the rest of us with a gun at our head. So that allegedly makes them, we're supposed to think that, you know, that this makes them all great people. They're not just like muggers or home invaders or whatever, but somehow they have the right to rule us. They have the right to tell us everything we do in our lives. They know better than us. And they have the right to loot us at the same time they're ruling us. So I think more and more people are questioning that, and it's the red pill. I mean, once you start to question, once you start to think about things in a libertarian sense, in an anarchistic sense, the scales drop from your eyes and you see everything very differently. All the stuff that you were taught in the third grade about the glories of the presidents and the glories of the government and so forth, just you think, well, wait a minute, that was all just baloney. So I think kids are rejecting the baloney, and they are much more interested in the truth, economic truth, historical truth, political truth. So it's very, very exciting to be among young people and to see them in action on the internet, too.
Absolutely. Lou Rockwell, thank you so much for spending the hour with me. You can find out more about him at lourockwell.com and also at the Von Mises Institute. Thank you again, sir.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.